An ambush blamed on Daesh terrorists have left more than 50 people dead in central Syria. The White House says the militaries of the U.S. and China are not communicating after recent downing of a Chinese balloon in American airspace. As 6 people lost their lives at a new shooting incident in the U.S., this time in a small town in the state of Mississippi. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in World News. In our top story, at least 53 people are killed in an ambush in central Syria, which media has blamed on Daesh terrorists. Syrian official says 46 civilians are among the dead. Victims had gunshot wounds to the head. Other details are sketchy, and there's been no claim of responsibility yet, but the Daesh terrorist group has in the past killed or kidnapped many people in central, northeastern, and eastern areas of Syria. The latest such incident was on Saturday when 16 people were reportedly killed by the terrorists. Remnants of Daesh are still active in parts of the country after their defeat in 2018. UN believes their group maintains about 10,000 terrorists in the country and neighboring Iraq. Leader of Yemen's Ansar al-Allah movement says U.S., Israel, and their allies have been committing a wide range of crimes against regional countries to stop their development. Abdulmalik al-Houthi says the West creates and nurtures Takfiri terrorists in the region while looting nations' wealth. Houthi added the U.S. also prevents Muslim nations, including Yemen, from acquiring weapons to defend themselves. He said U.S. has also been providing all kinds of support to Israel, which continues to commit acts of aggression against Palestinians on a daily basis. He said U.S. and its allies targeted with sanctions any independent country not living by their standards. Ansar leader said U.S. commits these crimes against humanity while claiming to be an advocate of human rights. He said that some Arab states have been colluding with the U.S. to help Israel establish hegemony in the region. Another shooting in the U.S., this time in Mississippi. A gunman goes on a rampage, killing 6 people throughout different locations before being arrested. Carnage took place in a small rural town along the Tennessee-Mississippi border. First, gunman went to a store and shot a man before going to 2 homes and killing 3 people there. Officer found other victims in another location. Shooter was arrested after a car chase. Authorities believe the suspect acted alone and no motive is yet unknown. U.S. has been witnessing major escalation in gun violence. More than 600 mass shootings were recorded throughout the country during 2022. That's why Congress is still reluctant to pass strict gun control regulations. Russia slammed U.S. for playing a direct role in the war with Ukraine. Moscow says Washington is provoking Ukraine to drag the war into Russian territory. Earlier in our news review, we discussed the issue with our guests.
Hello and welcome at News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, Russia warns that the U.S. is now directly involved in the war in Ukraine after an American official expressed support for Kiev's attack on Russian annexed Crimea.
Here's one of U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland's remarks that Washington supports. Just think about this: Ukraine's strikes against Russian military infrastructure in Crimea. She also considers the demilitarization of the Russian peninsula a practical option. Once again, we are forced to state the United States' involvement in the conflict in Ukraine. They incite the Kiev regime to further escalate and move the war over onto the territory of our country in this way, by direct strikes. This is what we warned about earlier and why we have been forced to start this special military operation.
Zakharova said the U.S. supplies Ukraine with large quantities of weapons, provides intelligence, and participates directly in the planning of combat operations. She said this is because some U.S. officials are dreaming like, quote, crazies of defeating Russia. Earlier, U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland had called for Crimea to be demilitarized at a minimum for Ukraine to be safe. Russia annexed Crimea in 2014 after holding a referendum there. Ukraine and its Western allies have refused to recognize the vote. Last month, the Ukrainian president expressed hope for the reconquest of the region. Russia has warned that it would defend Crimea and other Ukrainian regions that it annexed last year. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Johnny Miller, who's joining us from Donetsk. Also, we have Professor of International Human Rights at University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Daniel Kovalik, who's joining us from Pittsburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. First of all, let's start off with Johnny in Donetsk. Johnny, two different aspects. First of all, we want an update from the situation on the ground. Also, if you may walk us through the recent comments made by Russia, warning basically that the U.S. is now directly involved in the war in Ukraine.
Well, yes, on the front lines at the moment, it's still relatively static. Russia making some gains and a lot of talk about a big Russian offensive. Whether that will happen or not, we're not sure. But coming up to the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion, or the special military operation, as they call it, and so many people are waiting for this Russian offensive, whether it will come or not. But in terms of Victoria Nuland's recent comments, I spent a lot of time in Crimea recently, and one story that's not being covered very much is the fact that the vast majority of people in Crimea, a healthy majority or a vast majority, somewhere between the two, of people in Crimea, not only want to be part of Russia, but they describe themselves as Russian. I spent a lot of time speaking to people on the streets of Crimea, that's an important story to recognize, that the vast majority of people in Crimea see themselves as Russian. And so these recent comments by the United States or United States personnel encouraging Ukraine to attack Crimea obviously is a big problem for Russia. Russia sees Crimea as vital to its strategic interests.
Daniel Kovalik, let's start off with the recent comments coming from a Russian spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova. Some of the comments there stating that basically the U.S. is now directly involved in the war. That was a notion that many probably agreed with prior to these statements. And also stating that basically Western allies, they're acting like madmen just wanting to get a win over Russia.
Yeah, well, I think it's very true. And I have thought that the U.S. has been involved in this war against Russia from the very beginning. And when I say the very beginning, certainly as far back as 2014, when the war by the government in Kiev against the Donbass began. And certainly they've insinuated themselves even further into this conflict. And, you know, when you talk about mad people running the show and engaged in insane conduct, I think one has to look at the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines, which, as Seymour Hersh has revealed, and as many of us suspected from the beginning, the U.S. was involved in. It shows the U.S. will stop at nothing to try to undermine not only Russia, but frankly, its own allies in Western Europe. That attack on Nord Stream was the greatest and worst active environmental terrorism in known history. And again, it shows the lengths the U.S. is willing to go to in this conflict. And there are remarks, of course, by U.S. officials, which indicate the U.S. may even be willing to use nuclear weapons. And it goes beyond just providing weapons. We know from former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett that the West has directly interfered in attempts, even by Israel, to mediate a peace between Russia and Ukraine. The U.S. in particular and Great Britain do not want peace here, and they have done everything to derail peace talks. We know that Boris Johnson flew on a surprise visit to Kiev to tell Zelensky back in April not to sign a peace deal, that apparently there were at least an outline agreement on. And yeah, of course, the continued sending of weapons is only going to continue this conflict. It's not going to change the, you know, outcome of it. I think in the end, Russia will be victorious. But in the meantime, many Russians and many Ukrainians are going to die. And frankly, showing that the West doesn't really care about Ukraine or Ukrainians. They just want to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian, as people like Lindsey Graham have been open about.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Johnny Miller, of course, joining us from Donetsk. Also, thanks to Professor Daniel Kovalik joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Cost of living crisis in Europe has triggered fresh protests and strikes across the continent. In Spain, thousands of supporters of the public health system have protested in Madrid over what they're calling destruction of the public health system by conservative regional government. And in Portugal, thousands of teachers there have also held rallies in the capital, Lisbon, demanding higher pay and better working conditions. It was the third such protest in less than a month in the country.
Protesters have returned to major cities across Europe to voice their anger at the rising cost of living across the continent. In Spain, people held a massive rally in Madrid against what they call the regional government's dismantling of the public health care system. Officials say 250,000 people turned out, but organizers put the number as high as a million. That is the largest such demonstration in recent months. Protesters accuse the regional government of prioritizing private health. They say the public health service is suffering from staff and equipment shortages because of the government's policies. Some primary care doctors and healthcare workers have also been holding regular strikes over better working conditions and pay.
The condition of the public health system is deteriorating. The number of doctors have been decreasing with medical conditions getting worse. Many medical centers have been closed.
The region's right-wing leader has repeatedly claimed that the protesters are motivated by political interests. And in the Portuguese city of Lisbon, tens of thousands of teachers have taken to the streets amid public discontent over the cost of living crisis. It is the third time in less than a month that teachers and school workers have held mass demonstrations. Teachers want a pay rise and are also calling on the government to speed up career progression. Officials say negotiations with teachers' unions are ongoing and express hope that an agreement would be reached soon. Portugal is one of Western Europe's poorest countries, which is seeing decades-high inflation and is grappling with the cost of living crisis.
We are here to claim our rights, which were taken away from us a long time ago. Our careers have been frozen for a long time, and that can't be. We have the right to have a more dignified career. We can't work like this. It just can't be.
And in Germany, the travel sector has witnessed widespread chaos after major trade union called on airport workers to go on strike over pay. And in France, workers there have staged fresh protests and walkouts against the government's pension reform plans, which will raise the retirement age to 62, from 62, that is, to 64.
Protests in Spain and Portugal come as passengers across Germany have witnessed widespread travel chaos after a major trade union called on airport workers to go on a strike over a pay dispute. Verdi Trade Union called for the industrial action after it said collective bargaining efforts to settle wage disputes with the government failed. Since last year, European airlines have been facing labor strife amid staff shortages and soaring inflation, which have prompted employees to demand higher wages. German officials say despite a recent improvement, the economy is expected to suffer another mild decline in early 2023, as energy prices for households are still increasing. German consumer prices, harmonized to compare with other European Union countries, peaked at 11.6% in October, driven by the surge in energy prices and rising input costs. In the UK, more than 70% of UK households fear that they will be severely hit by the cost of living crisis in the first part of 2023, up from 54% at the end of last year.
Nobody actually wants to be on strike. We want to do our jobs. We want to look after the students here. This is what our passion is. But we've been driven into a situation where we can't even pay our bills now. So basically, we've been forced to do this. Nobody works in education to be rich. But we'd like to have a decent standard of life. And I think we're losing a lot of staff as well. A lot of people are leaving because of the pay.
Meanwhile, in France, police clashed with people protesting the government's pension reform bill. Hundreds of thousands of people attended the rally, which was held in a number of other cities across France, seeking to keep up pressure on the government over the reform plan, which aims to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. President Emmanuel Macron says the reform is vital to ensuring the viability of the pension system.
We would like the age of retirement to remain the same. 62 is already enough for working people like us. We work in kindergarten in the way, and we don't see ourselves working with children at 64. It's already quite hard currently, and going farther isn't possible.
This is a democracy, and people only have a month to debate the pension reform. The government has kept its project hidden for months, despite the fact that it was ready, and they only yield on details when people take to the streets. Well, we will keep going.
The economic crises have been compounded by the protracted war in Ukraine. The war has pushed up prices, including the price of commodities like energy products. Furthermore, European nations have pledged billions of dollars worth of military aid to Ukraine. And that has sapped the capacities of European major economies to spend money on social welfare programs.
In Peru, the Congress has passed a constitutional complaint against former President Pedro Castillo to charge him for corruption. Approval of the complaint gives the green light to the country's AG, that's the Attorney General, to formally indict Castillo. Congress also backed complaints against two former ministers who served in the former government. And Castillo was ousted and detained in December after attempting to dissolve Congress to escape impeachment. And since then, Peru has been the scene of violent protests, which have left dozens of demonstrators dead. Protesters are calling for early elections, and they want to see incumbent President Dina Boluarte resign. Devastation, destruction, and despair, that's the picture in quake-hit regions of Turkey and Syria. But news of miraculous survival under the rubble of collapsed buildings can at times relieve people's pain and grief. A teenage boy and two men were found alive in Turkey after being trapped under debris for 11 days. While such rescues are becoming rare, operations to find survivors are still underway in impacted regions. Freezing weather, however, has frustrated efforts. Combined death toll from the 7.8 magnitude earthquake that jolted Turkey and Syria on the 6th of February has now topped 43,000. The natural disasters also injured and displaced thousands of people in the two countries. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The Limelight. With the acknowledgement of investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, quoting informed American sources, the Biden administration was involved in the explosion of the Nord Stream pipelines that transported Russian gas to Europe. The case has now gained new dimensions. We take a look at the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia's Itatas news agency has covered this story and tells us more. In September of 2022, a number of blasts occurred in the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipelines. Following the attacks, there were gas leaks around the pipelines, which were built to transport natural gas from Russia to Germany through the Baltic Sea. Both pipelines are majority owned by the Russian state-owned gas company Gazprom. At the time, there was much speculation about who may have been behind the sabotage. But now leading U.S. journalist Seymour Hersh has blamed the blast on Washington. In a detailed report published in his blog, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has said that bombing of the Nord Stream underwater gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea was ordered by the Biden White House and carried out by the CIA, with the help of the U.S. Navy. Seymour Hersh says the findings are based on his own investigation into last September's sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines. He says U.S. Navy deep-sea divers planted the high-powered C-4 explosives under gas pipelines under the guise of a NATO naval exercise. The bombs were detonated on 26th of September last year using a remote signal sent by a sonobuoy, which was dropped near the Nord Stream pipelines from a Norwegian Navy P-8 surveillance plane. The planning process began in December of 2021, when a special task force was created in joint participation with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The White House dismissed the report, but Russian officials say the published facts should become the basis for an international investigation. Recently, Germany's public prosecutor general, Peter Frank, said that Berlin has no evidence linking Russia to the sabotage of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. According to Seymour Hersh, the Biden administration was focused on the Nord Stream pipelines because as long as European countries like Germany remain dependent on Russian gas for cheap energy, they would be reluctant to give military aid to Ukraine for a war with Russia, which was looming at the time. The United States has always been a major opponent of the Nord Stream pipelines. In 2019, former US President Donald Trump said Nord Stream 2 would turn Europe into a hostage of Russia and consequently place sanctions on any company assisting Russia to complete the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. In December of 2020, President-elect Joe Biden, as he was at the time, expressed his opposition to the opening of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Swedish and Danish investigators have already found that the ruptures were the result of sabotage, but have not yet specified who was responsible for the attacks. The attacks occurred in the exclusive economic zones of the two European countries, Sweden and Denmark. Since the blast occurred, Moscow has blamed the West for the damage to the infrastructure. Russia's Sputnik News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Sunday, 12th of February, officials in the United States admit that they were behind the explosions of the Nord Stream pipelines. The Russian Foreign Minister said, now they even enjoy talking about it, adding that the U.S. sabotaged the Russian pipeline in order to destroy a powerful alliance based on Russian energy resources and German technology that began to threaten the monopoly of many American corporations. Sergei Lavrov's comments come on the heels of a bombshell revelation by Pulitzer Prize-winning American journalist Seymour Hersh, who wrote an investigative piece recently into the gas pipeline explosions. Based on information from sources, Seymour Hersh wrote that during the NATO Baltic troops exercise in the summer of 2022, U.S. Navy divers planted explosives under the Nord Stream pipelines, which were detonated 3 months later at the orders of U.S. President Joe Biden. According to investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, Joe Biden decided to sabotage Nord Stream after more than 9 months of secret discussions with his national security team. Seymour Hersh also cited a source with direct knowledge of U.S. operational planning as saying that Norway played a key role in helping the United States organize the attack and keep the Swedish and Danish navies in the dark. The Pentagon has denied responsibility for the blasts. Sputnik News Agency has analyzed Flight Radar 24 data showing that U.S. and German Navy aircraft regularly circled over the sites of future explosions on the Nord Stream pipelines during the NATO BALTOPS 22 exercise last summer. Between 8th of June and 16th of June last year, German and U.S. maritime surveillance aircraft P-3 Orion and P-8 Poseidon carried out regular flights over the sites of future Nord Stream blasts. The military aircraft descended to low altitudes and turned off their transponders in almost every flight, so some of their trajectories remained unrecorded. On 8th of June last year, The American Poseidon aircraft circled over the sites of three future explosions on the Nord Stream pipelines northeast of Bornholm Island. The German P-3 Orion aircraft then flew over a future blast site east of the island of Bornholm. On 9th of June last year, the Poseidon aircraft flew over the sites northeast and east of the island of Bornholm. From 11th to 15th of June last year, the US Poseidon aircraft circled precisely over the sites of future Nord Stream sabotage acts every day, often making many turns and loops at low altitude. On 16th of June last year, the German P-3 Orion flew over the same area. The minimum flight altitude of US and German military aircraft over the Baltic Sea around the location of the gas pipelines was less than 600 meters. However, it could have been even lower in those parts of the flights that were not recorded by the open monitoring system. Late last month, US Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland hailed the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, saying, "The United States administration is very gratified to know that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is now, as you like to say, a hunk of metal at the bottom of the sea." The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, pointed out that Victoria Nuland's words were proof of the Biden administration's approval of the terrorist attack that destroyed the Nord Stream pipelines, as well as evidence of Washington's motive for undermining global energy security. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, for his part, described the pipeline explosions as a tremendous opportunity, which would enable the European Union nations to become less dependent on Russian gas. The blast occurred on 26th of September last year at three of the four strings of Nord Stream 1 and 2 underwater pipelines built to carry a combined 110 billion cubic meters of Russian gas to Europe annually. The incidents halted gas deliveries to Germany ahead of the cold season, prompting a gas price hike and a scramble for alternative sources of natural gas in the European Union. Germany, Denmark and Sweden launched separate investigations into the acts of sabotage, with German media reporting trust issues among the three EU nations. Russia's chief prosecutor's office said it had opened an inquiry into the possible international terrorism.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and let us listen to a thought-provoking saying from the Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him. For the steadfast, a misfortune is only one, while it is twofold for the impatient.
Thank you.
congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 27th of Rajab, the Feast of Mab'ath, which marks the formal appointment of Prophet Muhammad by God for guidance of mankind. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all Muslims throughout the world on this auspicious occasion.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, moderation. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of moderation in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that anything that is being used in the excessive way is harmful for the mankind. And if we exceed the limits in any case, that is harmful. Therefore, it is better to follow the way which is moderate. And we must follow the moderate way. The reason is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created everything through justice, and He wants us to observe this justice in our life. Therefore, when we observe the justice in our life, we become muttaqi, or we get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In order to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to have a moderate lifestyle, to not exceed the limits, which means that if we have wealth, we should not waste that. We should not become extravagant. We must not do israf in our life. And this moderate way will take us to the success. It will take us towards the perfection. And therefore, when we look at the Quranic teachings, even in the Quranic teachings, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, وَمَا خَلَقْنَا السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا إِلَّا بِالْحَقِّ. We have not created this, the heavens and the earth and whatever is in between them, except the truth. Now, this truth means that there is no excessive in it. There is no extravagance in it. It has been created with the moderation amongst the creatures. Therefore, we must observe this moderation in our life in order to have success in our life, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of moderation in the Islamic lifestyle. When we say moderation, it means that we need to observe the moderate way in order to reach to the perfection or have the best Islamic lifestyle. The best Islamic lifestyle cannot be gained without the moderation or having the moderate way of living a life. Therefore, it is necessary upon all of us. When Allah has created everything through the justice, therefore, when we are saying that we need to observe this justice, it means that we need to follow the moderate way. We should not exceed in the limits. And these limits are been said in the Quran and in the Islamic teachings. These limits, which are known as halal and haram, we must observe them. When a person is observing everything which is halal And everything which is forbidden, he avoids that as a haram. He is following the moderate way. Basically, a person who performs a sin, a person who performs the haram things, it means he's exceeding the limits. He has left the moderate way. Similarly, when a person is performing a halal thing, when he is observing the halal or wajibat, the obligatory practices that he has to do or rituals that he is performing, it means that he is following the moderate way. But if he leaves the obligations, the obligatories that he has, then it means that he has left the moderate way. Therefore, the shortcut of following the moderate way in order to have an Islamic life is to perform the obligations, to go for the halal, and to avoid the haram, and to not to perform anything which is haram or forbidden in Islam. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
UK household budgets are becoming increasingly stretched. And as the cost of living crisis worsens, vulnerable families and their children are being pushed to the edge.
People are struggling to eat. People are struggling to heat their homes as well. That has a knock-on effect in terms of general health and well-being. So we get more people that turn up at accidents and emergency, more people that might be using drugs and alcohol to alleviate the symptoms caused by the poverty that they're feeling.
Around 13.4 million people were living in poverty in the UK between 2020 and 2021, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Analysis from the foundation has revealed 3.9 million children were living in poverty in the UK in the same period of time.
We regularly have people who come in that may not have eaten for 2-3 days. We didn't used to see that before. I also had a family where one night they fed the son, the next night they fed the daughter because they can't feed everyone. I just think it's shameful that we're in a relatively wealthy city that we have people that are struggling so, so much.
Child poverty increased most dramatically in the northeast of England between 2015 and 2020, rising by over a third, from 26% to 37% of all children. Demand for free school meals is also highest in the Northeast, where around 29.1% of children currently qualify, compared to just 17.6% in the Southeast.
We all know inflation's going up, you know, by a lot, but it's people that are on the lowest incomes that will suffer the most, because the products that they're buying, so basic food, isn't just going up by 10% or whatever, it's going up by 100%.
But while the Northeast now has the highest rate of child poverty across the regions, many of the worst affected constituencies and local authorities continue to be in London, according to Action for Children. This is due to high housing costs in the capital. The Childhood Trust has found 40% of children aged 6 to 16 are facing food poverty in London, meaning their families cannot afford to keep them fed.
In a city like London, one of the most thriving cities in the world, it's shocking. It's shocking to think that that number of children and our families are struggling to make ends meet and are struggling to provide the food that they need for their families. It's really quite a shocking statistic, I think.
In the words of Lawrence Guinness, Childhood Trust chief executive, "We've never seen levels of food insecurity at that high before. It's an alarm bell in the face of growing adversity and the diminishing power of household income." Tower Hamlets is the borough with the highest rate of child poverty after housing costs, with a rate of 51%. Child poverty rates are also high in other large cities like Birmingham and Manchester. The latest data available shows children from black and minority ethnic groups are more likely to be in poverty at 46% compared to 26% of children in white British families. Children's charities, schools, and food aid organizations are working tirelessly to plug the gaps created by the welfare system. Food banks are now being set up in schools so children have enough to eat.
Research by the Child Poverty Action Group earlier this year estimated that one in three school children living in poverty don't qualify for a free school meal. So when we talk about hunger, we're talking about children coming to school and relying on a hot, nutritious meal at lunchtime. And the figures around the one in three are sitting at around 800,000 children. And that's why we're running a campaign to extend eligibility so more families living in poverty can access good nutrition at lunchtime.
Living in poverty can have a serious impact on a child's well-being. Some report feeling ashamed and unhappy and worry about their parents. Disadvantaged children are more likely to develop severe mental health problems by age 11 than their well-off peers. Kids in inadequate housing have been shown to be more at risk of respiratory illnesses and meningitis. Those in the most disadvantaged areas can expect 20 fewer years of good health in their lives than children in places with more resources.
So when you're living in a cold, damp home, that causes huge problems. If you're in, if you've got pre-existing heart conditions, if you've got respiratory illnesses such as long COVID or COVID itself, if you've got asthma or COPD or other lung conditions, all of those things are made much, much worse by living in a cold, damp home. If you're recovering from surgery, that can take longer for your wounds to heal because you're living in a cold, damp home. So there's a whole range of different things that are affected by the problem of fuel poverty, and that's why if we don't solve these things through economic measures, we're going to see a long-term health crisis affecting our country.
On the rise alongside poverty is childhood obesity, with rates at an all-time high. Children aged 4 to 5 in the most deprived 10% of the population are 75% more likely to be overweight or obese than those in the most affluent 10%. Poverty even puts kids at greater risk of being groomed or exploited by criminal gangs. There are reports that children whose families are mired in deep poverty are stealing basic items such as food and tissues from their schools, and some are missing lessons altogether because they cannot afford the bus fare. In November last year, The Independent published a horrible report about schoolchildren and parents shoplifting to feed themselves and their families. Meanwhile, the Children's Society is warning that government support does not go far enough, as thousands of children are at risk of malnutrition this winter. Campaigners and economic experts have repeatedly called for an overhaul of the Social Security safety net, particularly reforms for universal credit and an end to the two-child limit to receiving some benefits. The 20-pound cut to universal credit in October 2021 plunged families back into poverty after giving them light relief throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. Surprisingly enough, successive conservative chancellors have reduced tax credits and benefits for low-income families with children while introducing tax cuts that have benefited the better off.
We are calling the government to increase its support in order to get through this winter. And we are also calling the government to think about enduring solutions, especially in the area of energy efficiency, in order to reduce very significantly the level of consumption of our customers.
According to The Observer, the UK has become a hostile place to have children, as parents are being forced to bring their offspring in conditions that will have grave repercussions for society. It starts even before birth. It's estimated that more than 1,000 babies die or are left with severe injuries each year as a result of something going wrong during labor. Meanwhile, the number of child abduction offenses has been on the rise. Over the past decade, nearly 10,000 children have been abducted. In one case in late January, dozens of asylum-seeking children were kidnapped by gangs from a Brighton hotel run by the Home Office in a pattern apparently being repeated across the South Coast. It has emerged that the Home Office was warned repeatedly by police that the vulnerable occupants of the hotel, asylum-seeking children, who had recently arrived in the UK without parents or carers, would be targeted by criminal networks. Child poverty in the UK is reaching worrying levels. Paltry wages, low benefit payments, and a cost of living crisis mean the UK's poorest families and their children are getting poorer. But will the UK government do something meaningful in this regard? History is not promising, but we'll have to wait and see.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
UN experts have said that the Zionist regime should be held accountable for acts of domicide. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. WAFA News Agency wrote in this regard, the international community must take action to stop systematic and deliberate housing demolition and sealing, arbitrary displacement, and forced evictions of Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank, UN experts have said recently. In the month of January 2023 alone, the Zionist regime's authorities reportedly demolished 132 Palestinian structures across 38 communities in the occupied West Bank, including 34 residential and 15 donor-funded structures. This figure represents a 135% increase compared to the same period in 2022 and includes the five punitive demolitions. The systematic demolition of Palestinian homes, erection of illegal Israeli settlements, and systematic denial of building permits for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank amounts to domicide. The experts reiterated their concern over the situation in Masafer Yatta, where over 1,100 Palestinian residents remain at imminent risk of forced eviction, arbitrary displacement and demolitions of their homes, livelihood, water and sanitation structures. In November 2022, the Zionist regime authorities demolished the donor-funded school in Esfey al-Fuqa. Four other schools in the area are also under demolition orders. The experts said direct attacks on the Palestinian people's homes, schools, livelihoods, and water sources are nothing but Israel's attempts to curtail the Palestinians' right to self-determination and to threaten their very existence. Israel's tactics of forcibly displacing and evicting the Palestinian population appear to have no limits. In occupied East al-Quds, tens of Palestinian families also face imminent risks of forced evictions and displacement due to discriminatory zoning and planning regimes that favor Zionist settlement expansion, the act that is illegal under international law and amounts to war crime. The experts also expressed alarm at the Zionist regime's endorsement and escalated practice of punitive evictions and demolitions and other punitive measures applied to perpetrators of attacks and their family members, such as revoking identity documents, citizenship and residency rights and social security benefits. On January 29th, the Zionist regime's authorities announced measures to immediately seal off family homes of those suspected of carrying out the attacks on 27th and 28th of January in occupied East al-Quds, including the attack in Nev Yakub settlement on January 27th, which killed at least 7 Israelis. Two families of the alleged attackers were forcibly evicted from their homes, and more than 40 people, including family members, were reportedly arrested in relation to the attacks. The rule of law must prevail in any state action against acts of violence, the sealing of family homes of suspected offenders, and the subsequent demolition of their homes is in fundamental disrespect of international human rights norms and the rule of law. Such acts amount to collective punishment, which is strictly prohibited under international law. The experts said, "We regret that impunity prevails, in particular for human rights violations and potential war crimes committed by the occupying power. It is high time for international education bodies to determine the nature of Israeli occupation and seek justice and accountability for all crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territory," the UN experts said. The experts have repeatedly raised concerns with the Zionist regime on these issues. No response has been received to date. The UN experts included Francisca Albanese, a special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. Balakrishan Rajagopal, special rapporteur on the right to adequate housing, and Paola Gaviria Batuker, a special rapporteur on the human rights of internally displaced persons, said, "Israeli occupation authorities done demolished a Palestinian house in the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Jabal al-Mukabber." She said that Israeli police accompanying a bulldozer barged their way into the neighborhood and cordoned off the 140 square meter family house of Adham Bashir before the heavy machinery knocked it down, reducing it to rubble. The house was demolished purportedly for being built without a license. During the ensuing confrontations, the heavily armed police opened fire towards local youth, injuring 25 by rubber-coated steel bullets and causing 5 others to suffocate from tear gas, as confirmed by the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, PRCS, medics. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency wrote, using the pretext of illegal building, the Zionist regime demolishes houses on a regular basis to restrict Palestinian expansion in occupied Al-Quds. At the same time, the municipality and government build tens of thousands of housing units in illegal settlements in East Al-Quds for Jews with the goal to offset the demographic balance in favor of the Jewish settlers in the occupied city. Although Palestinians in East Al-Quds, a part of the internationally recognized Palestinian territory that has been subject to Israeli regime military occupation since 1967, they are denied their citizenship rights and are instead classified only as residents whose permits can be revoked if they move away from the city for more than a few years. They are also discriminated against in all aspects of life, including housing, employment and services, and are unable to access services in the West Bank due to the construction of the Zionist regime's separation wall. According to a report by Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, the Israeli High Court could be liable for war crimes for their policies that led to the dispossession of Palestinians from their properties in Area C of the West Bank. The report, Fake Justice, shows that the court's support of Israeli regime planning policy is tantamount to support for dispossession and forcible transfer of Palestinians, a war crime under international law.
Midstream.
Seconds carried thousands of heart-rending scenes when the catastrophe befell Turkey and Syria at the dawn of February 6, with its dire effects still extending to this moment. The vast majority of the world came to the aid of Turkey, which was also devastated by the earthquake that occurred. With thousands of dead and wounded victims, global solidarity was the master of the scene, and every country started sending everything that came to mind via planes, trucks, and convoys to extend a helping hand to Turkey, with humanity almost covering the sky before stopping at Syria to manifest double standards in all its ugliness. It is crucial for me that you guys know that what I just said is not a diminution of what happened to Turkey. We are all in solidarity with the victims, because the basic principle of humanity is that it is indivisible. Unlike the majority of countries in the world that flattened it to the ground and crumbled it into particles when the matter came to Syria. The best proof is the picture whose Spain cut us deep as it documented the scene of the planes from every direction as they headed to Turkey, leaving Syria alone, except for its allies and those very few Arab states. There are no incidents here that one can evoke except that of the planes of countries which knew the way to the skies of Syria when they started bombing and destroying it and wreaking havoc and destruction on it more than a decade ago. Yet they chose to turn away from it when the catastrophe of the deadly earthquake befell it, and without an iota of shame, these states continued to shower us with the words of humanity as they themselves inhaled the stench of hypocrisy that reeked of them in an abominable way. As if the earthquake that struck Syria, which had a magnitude of about 7.8 on the Richter scale, was a cuddle by the earth, and its victims are not enclosed within the human rights articles claimed by the West. Hours turned to days. There might still be people living, waiting for someone to